here and you're a religious person or you're a believer in God and you're a Christian, no doubt you have all kinds of big questions that come up, even about your own belief system. Either you might be reading the Bible and some stuff seems confusing, or you might have an experience in life that just doesn't seem to gel with your beliefs and it raises doubts, or you might come into contact with other people's beliefs and they have all kinds of objections to throw in your direction. And so Christians have all kinds of tough questions. As do people that are non-religious, or are religious nuns, or are non-affiliates, or atheists, or agnostics, or I like to say in Australia, we're not really theistic, belief in God, or really atheistic, non-belief in God. We're more apatheistic. We just don't give a stuff. We're apathetic. Life's pretty good. Why do I even need to consider God? But there are huge questions that come up for all of us when it comes to life. And one of the most enduring challenges to the Christian faith throughout history has been this one. Why suffering? If God is all-powerful and all-loving, as the Bible seems to paint, why is there so much seemingly pointless suffering and evil in the world? And so what I want to do today is recognize that this isn't just an intellectual exercise for people, but maybe like me, this is the kind of question that for you gets really close to home. A number of years ago, nearly, 21 years ago now, I was 9 years old, and we had moved up to Brisbane as a family, and over Christmas we drove down to Melbourne to reconnect with family members, and then on the way back up, driving through the Blue Mountains. Very foggy day, kind of like this, couldn't see very far in front, and my dad was driving on the single lane road when a truck pulled out from a little side lane, and my dad was faced with this terrible split-second decision to either hit the truck or an oncoming car. And so he chose to hit the truck. This is the picture of our van after the emergency services had largely torn it to pieces with the jaws of life. The truck came in the front left passenger side of our van that my mum was in. Her legs were pinned in the wreckage, and I remember the memory seared into my own brain is of half of the car having come to a complete stop, of seeing my sister screaming in the middle bank, I was in the back seat, and my mum just slumped over in the chair. She headbutted a truck at 7 kilometers an hour, and her face was smashed in, caved in, and bloody. Now, we had to drive to Sydney Hospital. She was airlifted out after they cut her from the vehicle. They performed emergency surgery, removed half of her skull, allowed the brain to swell so that she wouldn't die under cranial pressure. And the doctor spoke with my dad and just said, look, it's not great. The likelihood that she's going to make it is low, and there's extensive brain damage, so you've just got to prepare yourself. Now, nothing in my young life of going to church up until this age of 9 prepared me for that kind of a moment. What I heard about Christianity was that God loves me and has a wonderful plan for my life. But that simple message just did not jive with this painful reality. And so I, in my young years, threw off belief in God. And I thought nothing of God. And I lived my late childhood and all of my teenage years as a functional atheist or apatheist, not giving mind to it anymore. Suffering was my biggest barrier to Christianity. Why would a good God allow this sort of stuff? Is he even there? Or is suffering evidence that God doesn't exist? Does he really care about human beings? Is he really sovereign or powerful or in control? Or did we do something wrong to deserve this? These are the sort of questions that everyone has to wrestle with. And when it comes to these sorts of tough questions, one of the things that I find unique is that the Bible is far from silent. Some of the so-called people of God, or the hero characters in the Bible, ask some brutally honest questions when it comes to suffering and evil in the world. And you might be completely new to the Christian story, but I want to share with you just one of the stories that comes from the Bible and the stories about Jesus. If you've never read one of the Gospels, the stories about the life of Jesus of Nazareth, I encourage you to, because they're full of these sort of fascinating little encounters. This comes from John chapter 9. It says, as he, Jesus, passed by, he saw a man blind from birth. And his disciples asked him, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? Jesus answered, it was not this man that sinned, or his parents, but that the works of God might be displayed in him. We must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. Night is coming when no one can work. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world. Having said these things, Jesus spat on the ground and made mud with the saliva. Then he anointed the man's eyes with the mud and said to him, go wash in the pool of Siloam, which means sent. So he went and washed, and he came back seeing. Now what's going on in this sort of tiny little bizarre story about some supernatural healing and human reasoning? It seems weird and crazy and the stuff of legend and fairy tale. Let me put it in context for a bit. This character, Jesus of Nazareth, he's been traveling around the Judean countryside. Everywhere he goes, people keep coming up to him as a traveling teacher, and like me, they ask him a series of tough questions. Whether they're friendlies, whether they're foes, they keep throwing out these huge grenades at him. And here in John chapter 9, the question about suffering is actually raised by some of his closest followers. You hear students rather than disciples, or apprentices to a great master, or if you're a Star Wars fan, Padawan learners to a Jedi master. And in their thinking, when they see an example of someone in pain, when they see an example of suffering, well, it has to be someone's fault. What did they do to deserve this? Was it this kid, this baby when he was young, or was it the parent? This has to be someone's fault. And I've been a pastor for a lot of years, and in my experience of walking with people, both religious and non-religious, people tend to reduce and make sense of suffering in one of two ways. Either, perhaps like Jesus' followers, they accuse the person suffering. Now, surely, since God is in control, he's big, he's watching over everything, and if he's good, then if you're suffering, it must mean that you deserve it, that you're getting kind of the karmic cycle, you reap what you sow. And so to be born blind, well, this guy must have screwed up. He must have done something wrong, either the baby or the parents. And if you read back across the Bible, there are a ton of people who make this misinterpretation. There's this one story in the Old Testament, a book called Job, as part of the wisdom literature. And in this big story, there is this guy who's pretty good with God, calls him a righteous man, and he was wealthy and healthy and a big family. And then in an instant, everything is robbed. The tragedy meant a house collapsed on his 10 kids and they're all killed. All of his wealth, caught up in the herds of the ancient world, was stolen from him in a day. And then he's left afflicted in his own body with a terrible disease. And he's literally sitting in the ashes of his former life when a bunch of his friends rocked up and just started to sit with him in the dirt. And they did the thing that's probably the best thing you can do for any of your friends who are suffering. They just sat with him. They were with him. And then they tried to make sense of why this started happening. So after 7 days, they opened their mouths and they started to say a bunch of dumb things like, what did you do to piss God off like this? I mean, he must be really mad if this is happening to you. And so they start accusing the suffering person. Or perhaps the other way around, people start to blame God. It's not the person's fault, it must be God's fault. And in this story of Job, after enduring round after round after round of his friends' accusations, eventually Job takes this line. He's like, look, I've done nothing wrong. I'm sure that I'm good with God. And if God's in control, then what's going on right now? Well, it must be his fault. He must be unjust. He must be unfair. And this, I would say, is kind of the default reaction of people in our culture. Let's check out this quick video of a story, an interview with the atheist Stephen Fry.
Suppose it's all true. And you walk up to the pearly gates and you are confronted by God. What will Stephen Fry say to him, her, or it?
I will basically, that is the Odyssey, I think, I'll say, bone cancer in children? What's that about? How dare you? How dare you create a world in which there is such misery that is not our fault? It's not right. It's utterly, utterly evil. Why should I respect a capricious, mean-minded, stupid God who creates a world which is so full of injustice and pain? Because the God who created this universe, if he was created by God, is quite clearly a maniac, utter maniac. Yes, the world is very splendid, but it also has in it insects, whose whole life cycle is to burrow into the eyes of children and make them blind.
that eats outwards from the eyes. Why? Why did you do that to it? It's perfectly apparent. He is monstrous, utterly monstrous, and deserves no respect whatsoever.
God, how dare you? See, for Stephen Fry, he says, how dare you allow bone cancer in children? Or for the character Job, God, how dare you take everything away from me? Or for me as a 9-year-old boy, God, how dare you let this happen to my family? Notice what Jesus does, though, in the story I read out before. You see, he doesn't actually buy into either misunderstanding. He doesn't say that it's the boy, he doesn't say that it's the parents, he doesn't say that it's God. He points to this idea that something more complex is going on behind the scene. But that even in the midst of the suffering, something of God can still be revealed. And he goes on to heal this guy who's suffering. See, according to Jesus, when it comes to the question of suffering, we can't jump to a reductionistic, simplistic answer. Something more complex is going on. I want to make a couple of observations about my processing of this as time went on. See, when I was 9, my immediate reaction to suffering was to run away from belief in God. I never stopped, though, to do what G.K. Chesterton, the great English Catholic writer and thinker, said. He said, in some situations we may be tempted to run away from God, but good heavens, to what? It's a very British phrase. Good heavens. You see, I didn't realize that if I'm going to run away from believing in God as a way of making sense of my life, then some other set of beliefs has to step in to fill that vacuum. And then I have to make sense of suffering in the rest of my life through some other lens. If I'm running away from God, I have to run to something. And I didn't realize as a 9-year-old that suffering is a problem for every single belief system, not just for Christianity. And when you start to review the various options that are out there, or places to which I can run, you realize that running away from God doesn't really help. Some of my friends growing up in high school were Buddhist. And let's say I was to travel over to Thailand and have a conversation about my experience of suffering with a Buddhist monk of the Theravada tradition. This is the tradition of Buddhism that's most closely linked with the teachings of Gautama Buddha. And if I was to relate my story of suffering to the monk, how would he make sense of it? Well, according to Buddhism, the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, they would begin by telling me that my suffering is really just an illusion. That it's not real, it's only imagined. And that the cause of my suffering is because I have desires, I'm too attached to this world. It's because I care about my mom, it's because I love her. That's why I suffer when I see her hurt. And his counsel to me to fix the problem would essentially be to shed myself of all connections and of all desire so that I can deny my very individual existence and seek oneness with the universe. In short, what they would tell me is that my suffering is not real. But suppose I find that option a little bit strange or disillusioning. My suffering feels very real. The experience seems so real. And instead now I travel over to where I studied in England, to Oxford, and I knocked on the front door of the high priest of New Atheism, Professor Richard Dawkins. If I was to relate my suffering to him as a naturalist, a physicalist, an atheist, what would he say? How would he explain it? Well, according to his worldview and to his writings, he would tell me that ultimately my suffering is just meaningless. That there's no rhyme or reason to it, that it's just bad cosmic luck. After all, he says in his book, A River Out of Eden, the universe we observe has precisely the properties we should expect if there is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, and no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. That's the atheist story that human beings inhabit. And he may, using all of his English compassion, try and console me and say, there, chap, it'll get better. But ultimately, he would be forced to say that my suffering is meaningless. And there's no ultimate hope for it to be undone either. For the only hope that the atheist story offers is the deafening silence of annihilation at death. Suppose then I get really disillusioned by the inevitability and meaninglessness of my suffering. We then travel back over to another one of my friends from high school. He was a Hindu. We which I'm off in India, and I walk into one of the temples there, and I speak to a Brahmin priest, and I tell them the story of my suffering, what do you think they would say? How would they make sense of that experience? Well, according to the teaching of the Vedas, which is the Hindu scriptures, the Hindu version of the Bible, they would tell me that my suffering, well, it is deserved. That the karmic cycle of reaping what you sow, whether in this life or the next, it assures me that what I'm experiencing right now is my just deserts. And they would tell me that the only course of action I have is to continue suffering, because it's the only means we have of paying off our karmic debt in order to gain a better reincarnation. Which was precisely why then Mother Teresa first went to the streets of Calcutta to build hospitals and orphanages to care for the widows and the sick and the dying. They tried to stop her because she thought they were doing them harm by disallowing them from suffering and hence paying off their karmic debt. In short, I would be told that my suffering is deserved, it's right. And so you see, as soon as you run away from belief in God and what the Christian story might say, it isn't helped by getting rid of God. Now, one another observation is this deep-seated belief that Stephen Fry has, that the world that we see, the suffering that we experience, is utterly evil. It's wrong. But why is it when we turn on the news and we see rape, murder, terrorism, famine, disease, we look at this and have this deep-seated feeling that this is not the way that things should be, that it's wrong? We speak of suffering in moral terms. Where does this belief come from? For surely it doesn't fit within the atheist story, where the universe has no good or evil, no rhyme or reason. It's indifferent to our experience. See, the very concept that we have, that the world is going wrong, that it's crooked, implies that we have a belief, an understanding of what it would look like if it was right, if it was straight. But C.S. Lewis brought up this point. Great writer in Oxford Don in the previous century, he was an atheist well into his adult years, and he opens a number of his books on Christianity by sharing he was an atheist for Stephen Fry's reasons. When he looked at the amount of suffering in the world, he said, how could this be the creation of an all-loving, all-powerful creator? Because something is so profoundly wrong with it. But then he said, but where did I get this idea the world is going wrong? This deep-seated belief actually implies that I know what is right, how things should be, that this is not the way that things ought to be. And this objection doesn't make sense without the existence of God. Because unless there is a moral lawgiver or a God to define what is good and evil, or unless the world was originally created in such a way in which it's gone wrong, there's no way for us to anchor this objection that suffering and evil are an argument against the existence of God in the first place, because you have to borrow the moral stick from the world of God's existence to try and declare his philosophical demise. The objection that suffering disproves God itself destructs, because in essence you can't make sense of the objection without God. Another observation that has been really helpful for me is a picture of my son Josiah. I don't know what happened in this photo. But when it comes to the question, why suffering? Should we expect to have all of the answers? Now, I don't know what the general opinions are around here, and not many of the political statement, but we decided to get my son vaccinated to get him immunized. When he was 18 months old, I took him into the doctor's surgery, and it was a point in that process where he had to get two needles. And every doctor knows that when you have a small toddler in front of you, you don't get two stabs at this part of the gun. And so the cheeky, evil doctor way that they've devised to do this is to have a doctor on one side and a nurse on another side simultaneously inject both needles, one in each arm. It's torture, right? And so what they asked me to do was to sit Josiah on my lap, to have him stare up at me, for me to hold his arms tight, and basically to lull him into a false sense of security. And I remember that fateful moment is his little face staring up at mine lovingly, and they just go, 1, 2, 3, jam! And his little body winces in pain, and his tiny eyes start filling up with tears, and his one unmistakable expression watches over his face. Betrayal. Dad, you're meant to love me. thought you wanted to protect me, you meant to keep me from suffering. Why would you let this happen? Now, there is no way that in his situation, as an 18-month-old boy, I could explain to him all that I understand about viral and bacterial infection and the necessity of antibodies and the concept of immunology. He just cannot understand that, given his mental faculty, the distance between me and him. And yet, if that's true of me as a 30-year-old to my 2.5-year-old son, how much more is that true of an infinite God whose mind understands all things and can see through the corridors of time, cause and effect of every action and decision. And then me, as a finite and fallen human creature, who not only doesn't have access to that same knowledge, but so often wrongly interprets what I see. Should we expect to have all the answers when it comes to the why suffering question? In the book of Job, that story, eventually Job begins to accuse God, and then God actually turns up in the story in a mighty wind. And you might expect God to give him a hug or say, I know you've suffered, and here's 15 reasons why I've let this happen. That's not what God does. Instead, God gives him this really annoying mid-semester exam. 64 individual questions that begin with things like, where were you when the foundations of the earth were laid? Tell me if you know. Where were you when I stretched out the heavens above and the land below? Answer me, dress like a man, and I will question you. He gets a real bad, hard set of questions. And then questions about the bigness of our universe and the parts that make it up, things that the human mind did not know. And God's point to Job was, you do not know what I know. You're not big enough to understand what I understand. And with my son Josiah, the question for him was, how do I explain this to him? The question is, does he know enough about who I am to trust that I have good reasons why I'm allowing him to suffer, even if he doesn't know what they are? Does he see enough of me to be able to love and lean in and trust that his father cares for him, even while I'm allowing this suffering to happen? And I think when it comes to the Christian story, that may be part of what's going on. Because as someone who has dug deep into the wells of Christian thinking and philosophy over the years on this subject, I'm going to tell you, the intellectual answers, even though they make sense, they don't do a lot to serve the heart, to make a difference in your experience of suffering. And so what I want to do right here is zoom out in the next sort of 15, 20 minutes and just paint a picture of how the biblical story or the Christian story as a whole, from beginning to end of the Bible, helps to make some sense of this question of suffering as to why God allows. But more than that, how it offers both a charter for how we're to deal with suffering as well as a hope, both of which you will not find in any other belief system. And on top of that, the reasons why, like as my son looked up at me wondering if he can trust his dad, the reasons why I myself ended up having my skepticism give way to faith as I saw and encountered a of God that I thought was profoundly trustworthy, even when I didn't have all the answers. See, the Christian story you could shape in a whole series of ways, but I'm choosing to break it up into five major scenes. It's like a movie of the Bible if you would do it this way. And in the first scene or act within the biblical story, we have this pattern of God created, of an all-wise, all-powerful, spiritual, timeless being creating all there is. Now, in this story, it gives a unique place to human creatures within this planet. Because it said that God, Father, Son, and Spirit, a triune community, an eternal relationship, love at its core, designed human beings for love and by love. And that human beings were made to bear God's image. And that might be foreign language to you if you've never read parts of the Bible or been exposed to the Christian story, but in essence, being made in God's image means that human beings were made to look like God in a way, to reflect like what God is like to the rest of his creation, to serve and do the kind of things that God does, to rule over, to subdue, to create. Human beings were given that charge. Now, human beings weren't created to be some kind of robots or automata. If God creates us by love and for love, to be able to love, well, that implies something very deep about our nature. Now, imagine if I chose a random lady in the audience today, and I wasn't married, and I walked up to you, and I put a gun to your temple. It's very bleak, disturbing if I would talk, but I put a gun to your head, and I said, tell me that you love me. What do you think most of the women in this room would do? You'd probably say it, right? No? Okay. I'm really impressed by your courage, but you'd probably go, I love you, lunatic. But the very act of coercion, of me putting a gun to your head, as someone else is listening to this, do you take their words to be meaningful? Why? Because that confession, that profession of love, it wasn't given freely. It wasn't offered. You see, love, we understand by nature, has to be freely given, freely reciprocal in that way. Otherwise, by definition, it's not love. It is forced, coerced, brainwashed. And so when God decided to create beings in his image, that meant a certain degree of moral freedom, of autonomy, of an ability to decide whether to trust God as an heavenly father to us as his earthly kids, to trust the moral boundaries that he set up for our existence, that they are for our good, for our flourishing, or instead to hate God, to reject God, to rebel against God, or in simple terms, to choose to define good and evil on our own. This is exactly how the biblical story plays out. Human beings were created with that kind of freedom, and as the ones who were set up to bear responsibility for what happens on this planet, to subdue it, rule over it, to cultivate it. What human beings chose to do, either trusting God or rejecting God, actually had effects for all of the world. The second scene of the Bible is what Christian thinkers or theologians call the fall. And what they mean is, it's a terrible descent from the original purpose of which we were made, the state of relationship between humans and God, humans and each other, and humans and the world, to what we now see going on all over the planet. Because rather than using our freedom to love God and to love others, instead we curved inwards upon ourselves. We became selfish, self-centered, allowing our desires to become disordered in all manner of ways. We misused our freedom, and this had all kinds of devastating effects, both for our relationships, as well as for our relationship with God, as well as for our relationship to the planet. Now, the natural laws, we understand by experience and observation and experiment, don't we? Imagine if I was to say to you, I'm going to go up to the building upstairs and put on a red cape and some red underwear on the outside, and I'm going to tell you that I disbelieve in gravity, and I'm going to jump off the edge of the building, and I'm going to break the law of gravity. What's going to happen? I think someone said splat. It's a little bit graphic, not really what I'm going for. Let's just say I won't break the law of gravity, I'll get broken in the process. Because natural laws operate irrespective of whether we believe in them or not. And if God exists and he has shaped this universe to have a moral fabric as well as natural laws, then in one sense we don't really break God's laws. We prove God's laws when we step outside and ourselves get broken in the process. See, this is precisely what the biblical story describes, that rather than loving God, loving others, instead, we put up all kinds of barriers between one for another. We became ashamed of who we were on the inside. We became damaged by evil. This separated us from God, a perfectly good, loving, just, judge, and heavenly Father. And it also separated us from one another. The biblical story describes the first humans as covering themselves with fig leaves to hide their shame, their nakedness. It's a powerful image as well of what we do every single day when we put a filter on any photo before we post it online. We edit ourselves in what we want the world to see because we're deeply concerned as to whether people will accept what's really on the inside. And what we saw happen in the fall wasn't something that just affected our relationship with God and with each other. It actually had cosmic effects, something called the curse, where now planet Earth itself bears the symptoms of the spiritual disease of human nature. You see, C.S. Lewis described one reason why God may allow suffering as being a way in which our suffering serves to wake us up that not everything is okay between creator and creation. That pain is God's megaphone to rouse the deaf world. Imagine if you had cancer and never shown any symptoms whatsoever, and then one day just died. The symptoms give you warning, opportunity to recognize, go to the doctor, get diagnosed, and seek a cure. And maybe pain, the suffering that we see in one respect, is such a symptom of a deeper spiritual sickness that now we're at odds, spiritually dead in our relationship with God. You see, free will, this twisting of a good thing given to us by God, is one of the major answers to why God ultimately allows suffering. That we're all part of the problem. And many of the people that I talk to about this subject will often ask, well, if God is loving, even if you let things go bad out there because of our free will, why doesn't he just come back and fix everything now? Bring an end to the suffering, bring an end to the evil and all the moral bad things that people are doing. And in essence, the Bible speaks to this as well. If its diagnosis is right, and we have a tremendous compliment being made in God's image, but also a deep critique that we've been damaged by evil, then if God comes to get rid of everything that's wrong with the world, what does that mean for you and me? If we're part of the problem, doesn't that mean that he has to get rid of us as well? Fix everything. In the New Testament, there's a book called 2 Peter, and there's this one verse where people are saying, well, surely, when's God going to come back and do all this stuff that you say? And the Apostle Peter writes that God is not slow in keeping his promises, as some understand slowness, but he is patient with us, not wanting any to perish, but all to come to repentance. Everyone to be woken up by this megaphone. Everyone to turn to the truth about how it is that God's going to fix both the evil in here as well as the evil out there. The third scene of the Bible's big story is really the coming of God onto the stage of planet Earth. That our evil, well, it may be the cause of suffering big picture, but just because someone's suffering, it doesn't mean that they've done evil for it. See, in Christianity, it's not the karmic cycle, which is precisely what Jesus said. Jesus says, neither this man nor his parents said he was born blind. And with Jesus, what we see is a window into the very nature of God. If you want to know what the Christian God is like, go and read the stories about Jesus. And here's a number of profound things that Jesus does. Jesus treats suffering, sickness, and death as enemies of humanity. As enemies of humanity. There's this one story in the Gospel of John, a couple of chapters after the one that I read, where one of Jesus' dearest friends, a man named Lazarus, he dies. And Jesus turns up 4 days after he'd been put in the ground, and his two older sisters, Mary and Martha, this is getting annoying. His two older sisters, Mary and Martha, well, they come to Jesus. One of them is weeping, and one of them is a little bit confused and upset and angry. And here's a couple of things that Jesus does. Jesus weeps with Mary as she weeps. Think about that idea of God weeping over the state, over evil, over death, over grief, that God shares in the tears of this world. In fact, that every tear that we shed is borrowed from God's divine eye. God isn't cold and indifferent to our experience. He's deeply moved by, he's moved to tears for those whom he loves. And the other thing the story says about Jesus, it says that he got really angry. Now, you want to read that if you pick up your English Bibles, because English translators don't know what to make sense of these verses. But twice in this text, it says that in English, deeply moved, in the Greek language, the original language of the Bible, it says that he was pissed. The physical image of the Greek word is of a snorting of the nostrils, like a bull when a matador does the big red cane before him. And my anger at this experience. And what is he angry at? He's angry at that death is unnatural for human beings in God's perfect design. That it is an enemy of humanity. And so, angry, he goes to the tomb. And he commands that Lazarus be raised from the dead. And he comes out. Jesus paints this picture through his life of healing supernaturally, of undoing the effects of evil and sin, of restoring injustices, of taking the way that people have corrupted systems of power to bring those who are weak and oppressed and ostracized back into the fold of the community. And he challenges corruption. And Jesus went about in his life destroying all of the effects of evil, which is why people who have said to follow Jesus have carried on that legacy by building hospitals, serving the poor, going to visit prisons, caring for those who have no one else to care for. But beyond the idea of Jesus just shedding tears and getting angry at evil and all of its effects to undo suffering, Jesus does something far deeper. He doesn't just shed tears, he sheds his blood. See, suffering is such a mega theme in the Bible, it's so central to the Christian story that the main picture that Christians hang around their neck and put on their churches is a totem of torture, a Roman means of execution, where God dies, where God willingly chose to allow himself to be crucified, to be nailed to a crossbeam of wood, to be suffocated after having already been scourged. Why? At any moment he could have left. He chose to remain, and it says that he did this to be able to bear the cost for our evil, to pay for our sin, to grab up all of the consequences, our sorrows, our suffering, our sin, and to wear that on the cross, to act in human's place so that we can ultimately be forgiven and find ultimate healing. If you want to know why suffering, I can't give you an answer. If there's some deep pain in your past, why did all that this happen? I have no way of saying it's because of this, that even that specific instance of suffering happened. But I can tell you what that instance of suffering doesn't mean. It doesn't mean he doesn't love you. Because once and for all, God proved the depth of his love for you and for me by embracing our suffering at the cross, by becoming a God with the scars, which he will bear for all eternity. And I wish I had time to unfold the sort of physical agonies that Jesus of Nazareth went through, not because it's macabre and to just move you emotively, but just so you can get the picture in your head of the depth of the love that God has for you and for me, if he's willing to suffer that kind of death. And so Jesus said, suffering, sickness, and death is wrong. Jesus gave a pattern of opposing it and wanting to see it undone through his life. And Jesus experienced our suffering by dying for us at the cross, that ultimate act, the proof of God's love to satisfy justice and set us free. And then he rose from the dead to be able to show that suffering, death, sickness is never the final word in God's story. The fourth thing that we have is this picture of the church. Now, this is after Jesus comes back from the dead. He sent all of those who believe in him to go and do what he did, to spread the message of what he's done for us in his death and resurrection so that we can be unified with God, but also to carry on the same legacy that he did, to oppose suffering, to oppose evil, to oppose injustice, to try and bring the same healing that Jesus brought to the rest of the world. Now, this time that we live in, between Jesus' first coming to deal with the human heart, evil in here, and then his second coming, it's a bit of a tough time. Christians believe that God supernaturally can still be involved in the world the same way that he was with Jesus. God can perform miracles and heal people. One of my own friends at the moment, a colleague, is just about to die of stage 4 stomach cancer. He's in the last moments. He's been battling this for about 9 months ever since he got a diagnosis. That entire period of 9 months, he has earnestly been praying, God, please heal me, God, please heal me, God, please heal me. And there are hundreds of thousands of people around the planet that are praying for this guy. He's a well-known figure. But at the same time, he's been praying, God, if you choose not to heal me, and I don't know why you would or wouldn't, I'm not in that position to know why, but if you choose not to, help me to suffer well. Suffer in a way that it's not meaningless, it's not pointless, but that it can be used in a significant way. And one of the things that Jesus of Nazareth gives and the New Testament speaks about is how God transforms our suffering. For those who believe in him, who love him, to bring about some kind of greater good in our life. That suffering doesn't have to destroy who we are. In my experience of working with hundreds of people through pain and tragedy, suffering has this unique ability to crowd out all the loud noise of life and make you ask life's most deep and important questions. What's it all for? Why am I really here? Have I just been playing with entertainment, jumping on some sort of success ladder when really it leads in there? And it's in people's experience of suffering that they most often encounter their deepest needs, the needs of the soul, to ultimately find its home in what they were created for, in a relationship with God. So too, if you were to take a survey of the greatest stories that we all love to read or watch, the movies, the great epic movies, why do we come to love certain hero characters? It's not because they were silver spoon fed from their life and never had anything go wrong. We tend to dislike those characters. They annoy us. The characters that we most admire are those whose character and courage have been forged through the fires of struggle and temptation and suffering that they've come out the other side, maybe with scars, but it's through this suffering that they've been made. And the New Testament speaks in this way about suffering being like a fire, a forge, that ends up shaping us if we cooperate with the God and his purposes for our life. It shapes us, molds us, become the kind of people that look a lot more like Jesus. There's this beautiful passage in Romans 8:28 where it says, "For those who love God and are called according to his purpose, he works together all things for good." And the gift of retrospect in my own life has allowed me to see back at least some ways in which events that at their time seem terrible and things that I would never want to happen, yet in who I am now and what I'm doing today have been incredibly potent in shaping and opening up doors of opportunity and making me far more compassionate and understanding of others so that I can walk with them in the midst of their pain. In such a way that I'm not even sure if I had the opportunity to, I would undo those experiences. See, the final picture of the Bible is a picture of what we call new creation, of Jesus returning a second time, not just to deal with evil in the human heart, but actually to get rid of all the evil. And the final pages of the Bible, Revelation 21:4, it says that God comes so near to you and to me that he will wipe away every tear from our eyes, so that there will neither be death anymore, nor pain, nor mourning, nor crying anymore. For the old order of things has passed away. Behold, he comes to make all things new. See, in the Christian story, even though we suffer, and our suffering can serve a purpose to make us more like God, to give us more compassion for others, to help us connect and come outside of our own selfish selves, although suffering can serve a purpose, it still is an enemy that one day will be undone. It's something that God promises to return. The great writer J.R. Tolkien uses this line in one book, C.S. Lewis stole it from him. He says, God will make all the sad things come untrue. That the point of the new creation is that whoever is dead will be raised from the dead again. Whatever has been done to you in some way will be undone. That God will set everything to right. Perfect justice will be restored. He will deal with evil. Those who choose to bring their evil to God to have their hearts remade, well, they're going to be prepared for God's future world. For those who want to hold on to their evil and instead continue to accuse God and go on their own, well, they'll be exiled from God's new creation, quarantined, so that they can't corrupt it anymore. But the great story of the Bible is that there is a profound hope. A couple of years ago, my wife and I, we put her granddad in the ground. He was the first in her family to die. It wasn't the first in any sense for me. Atheism says he's gone. He's just fertilizing. Christianity says that death is just a doorway into a life beyond. And then one day, our immaterial self will be reunited, just like Jesus rising from the dead with a new resurrected body, one no longer capable of the same ailments and suffering that we experienced here in this life. See, as a Christian, I can stand by someone's deathbed And I can promise that when they close their eyes and they've trusted in Jesus for him to forgive and deal with the evil in their heart, that when they open them again, they'll stand in the presence of their loving Heavenly Father. That one day they'll be resurrected from the dead to live with God for all eternity here on the remade earth. The curse is lifted, and suffering, sickness, death, these great enemies of humanity are no more. Let me tell you, human beings cannot live without hope. And most of the people that I know, even the agnostics, atheists, and even atheists, they still live as though they have hope, even if they believe intellectually that they don't. And so, friends, what I want to say is this. Suffering gets no easier when you run away from God. But it does get easier when you run to him with your suffering. And God may, in his gift of grace, decide to relieve your suffering supernaturally, or may provide for different ways to relieve that through modern medicine. But he also may not. He may shape you through suffering so that you become more like him, selfless, heavenly-ish being, rather than a selfish, hellish being. He may use your suffering to help you connect with others and share the story of Jesus' suffering. But here's what I want to say. You will not get all the answers, either from Christianity or from anyone. But Christianity offers a God who promises to be with you in your suffering, who is willing to suffer for you as an explanation, a demonstration of his love. And Christianity offers a hope, a deep and profound hope, that suffering is not the final word. Death is now just a shadow of what it once was. And so I want to invite you to read the stories about Jesus for yourself. If he is God in the flesh, you really know exactly what God is like. Then his answers are profoundly more helpful, more intellectually robust, and more full of hope than anything else you'll find. Thanks very much.
So at the moment we have the one question texted in. So the question is, why would an all-powerful God choose to use evolution, a destructive process that not only relies on death, but also involves much suffering, to create humans? It seems like he could have easily used something like a special kind of creation event. So why?
Yeah, I think it's a really fair question. One delineation that I'm going to make super clear, but it's part of the kind of discussion around suffering and evil, is a division between what we call moral evil, the kind of evil or suffering that we can explain because of human choices. When you feel lonely because someone shunned you, or where you see rape or murder, or all the kind of human choices that result in the suffering of others, we can make sense of that according to free will. But then there's this other category, we might call natural evils, or things that stem from natural suffering, and this is earthquakes and tsunamis and disease and sickness and all these things. Where do these come from? Because if we trace our Earth's history back as best as we're able through different historical sciences, we come to the point of realizing it seems to be that there's this long history of various development and animals and death being part of the purpose or being published God's got human beings here. Christians across the board probably answer this in a number of different ways, depending upon their own way of wrestling with scripture and the record of nature. A couple of ways to think about this would be the idea that when God created, he created a world that already bore the marks of a later fall. And what I mean by this is, in the same way that people before the coming of Jesus could be saved by God on the basis of what Jesus did, that Jesus' future death on the cross could retroactively be applied to help others, so too the future fall of human beings retroactively applied to be woven into the fabric of the universe that God made, that it bears already the marks of a damaged world. And then he set a particular paradise then, just a one fell garden that had been shaped from the raw materials of this rather chaotic existence to be able to put human beings in and ask them to expand the circles, essentially, of that cultivated garden. Which is precisely why they weren't originally created immortal, according to the Genesis story. As soon as they're separated from access to the tree of life, and they start to die. And so this picture, yeah, is of essentially a world that may already bear the marks of something that will be just done later. Another way of making sense of this, again, I just want to give you a few so you can go and explore these. Another way of making sense of this is to say that even before human beings made the decision to mistrust God, to find good and evil on their own, that there was another spiritual being that made that kind of decision. And so it speaks in the Bible about spiritual beings, of angels as well, that had access to God, maybe the degree of sentience and freedom as well, who made that likewise decision to rebel against God, where we get our whole idea of Satan or an opposer or an enemy in that respect. And that perhaps that rebellion had effects upon the world, what led it originally into chaos and God's working with what he has. And others would actually say that even though death and rhythm of seasons, life giving way to death within the natural world, that's actually part of God's original good design. It's only when human beings were breathed into it in a special way, became made in God's image, that death itself for them became something that was unintended, the wrong thing, and so a consequence of evil. And so there are multiple different ways which Christian thinkers make sense of how they feed this in. And they would say that it's only upon sentient self-reflection, that kind of experience of life, right relationship with God, that suffering and death is actually really a problem, that prior to that it was actually serving the purpose for which God created. So it depends upon how you reconcile your view on means or the mechanism that God used to create human beings with some of the few key options that I invite you to go and explore.
There are other questions coming in now. This question is in relation to that video of Stephen Fry that you showed. How would you answer the question, why should I trust a God who allows such evil and suffering to happen?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing I do is I understand the question. I think maybe as some Christians, we jump too quickly to try and defend without actually feeling the force of what people are saying. And when you go and you see the pain and the hurt around there, one of the things that he means so much is the fact that God didn't stay away. God actually entered into the pain and the mess to experience what we experience, to feel what we feel, to suffer, to be betrayed, to be beaten, to be crucified, to weep. God experiences the same things that we do. And so I would encourage people to look at the stories of Jesus and see what it was that God was willing to experience and see and do as a window into why I think we can. As I said before, I think the Christian story, it gives some answers to this sort of thing. I think somewhere wrapped up in the way that things are right now, it is a megaphone, it is a symptom of a much deeper problem that creator and creation is set at odds. And so I would say that this isn't the world that God intends. Because God values love and freedom so high and doesn't want to destroy our humanity, that that's one reason why God allows all manner of things to happen without intervening in that way.
This is a good question. I can definitely relate to it as well. Do you have any advice for dealing with the fear of suffering or death?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Fear, I guess, has to do a lot often with the ultimate consequence. Often fear is more about the unknown, what's going to happen in this space. And so I think in many respects, an antidote to fear is a good dose of healthy faith. Faith here isn't a blind leap in the dark. Faith isn't some Christian theological speak for the idea of believing in the absence of evidence. Christian faith is evidence-based. We believe on the basis of what we do know, and we trust God for what we haven't yet seen or what we haven't yet experienced. This is the entire reason why, when you're encouraged to believe in Jesus, it's not his duty, sense of things, so just believe him. We don't believe every other guy that comes up and says that he's God. We throw him in a mental asylum. The reason why we're meant to believe in Jesus is precisely because of the evidence that he laid out, both his claims are true, as well as that they're good news. And so in John's Gospel, for instance, the one I was speaking from tonight, he offers a series of the sayings of Jesus, his claims about himself, his identity to be God in the flesh, as well as a series of the actions of Jesus, the miracles of Jesus, the things that show that he's not just a crazy human, that he really does have supernatural divine power, and it's really kind of culminates in his resurrection from the dead. You can go and examine the resurrection of Jesus as a historical fact, the arguments there, and say, well, this seems to be the only good explanation is that Jesus of Nazareth rose from the dead. If that's true, then that's the rubber stamp of God's divine approval, saying that he was who he said he is. It's the proof that Jesus was God. And so the invitation for this fear question is to actually have faith in Jesus. Because when you come to faith in Jesus, you believe what he says. When Jesus said to Martha, "I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will never die, and though he die, will live." What Jesus is saying in that instance is, if he has the power to overthrow death, then what do you have to fear anymore? It was this very fact of the resurrection of Jesus that took his disciples, who were afraid of being arrested and being killed. They were terrified of death in that way. Except after they saw Jesus rise from the dead, guess what? Fear faded. We have strong historical evidence that at least five of Jesus' remaining 11 disciples were martyred for their confession that Jesus died and rose from the dead. They weren't scared of death anymore. Why? Because they know that on the other side of death, they're going to be with Jesus. Suffering comes to an end. All the sad things come untrue. And so, in the lead up to my granddad, I shared this story of him passing away. He has three adult sons, my father will be one of them, and then also an adopted daughter. The three sons are believers in God. His daughter, she knows the Christian story, but doesn't believe. When he was dying, wasted away by cancer, you've never seen a more cheery person, a more resolute, peaceful person. I met with him a few times, read the Bible, we pray. And he just tells stories about his faith in God, his experience of God growing up. But as he was nearing the end, his daughter, she couldn't handle the idea of he was about to die. She didn't know what to make of it. For her, death is this big black barrier. She doesn't know what happens afterwards. For him, death was an open door into the presence of God. And he was happy, ready, willing to take that step. If you're afraid of pain and death, it's totally understandable. It's the number one fear just behind public speaking. Legitimately. People prefer to die apparently than stand up in front of people. If you're afraid of death, if you're afraid of suffering, my encouragement is lean into what it was that Jesus said about himself and what he said about death and what he said about it being unknown. Because that's just going to change your view of life as a whole. It's a gift. You live it well while you're here. But it's just the beginning of an eternal journey. And you're very happy to let go of the struggle and the suffering of this life, if and when